You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, new polls suggest that a slender majority of British voters are now doubting whether leaving the EU is really that bright an idea. What happens if that number keeps going up? My guests Mary Dejewski and Robert Fox will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Angela Merkel's imminent meeting with Vladimir Putin, the final week of France's presidential election campaign, and later on...
You know Donald Trump doesn't drink, right? Who is tweeting at 3 a.m. sober? Donald Trump, because it's 10 a.m. in Russia. Those are business hours.
The White House Correspondents' Dinner. Was President Trump right to break with tradition and decline his invitation? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dejewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and Robert Fox, defence editor at The Evening Standard. Welcome both. And we will begin tonight here in the UK, whose Prime Minister is currently campaigning for a mandate to negotiate an outcome she campaigned against in the referendum called by her predecessor, despite the fact that he didn't intend to, and the results of which, according to new polls, a slender majority of the population have begun to rethink now that it's too late to stop them. A YouGov survey has found 45 to 43% against leaving the EU after all, with 12% either uncertain or too busy trying to pin down an Irish grandparent to answer. Mary, first of all, what happens if over the next 2 years we start to reach a point at which those numbers approach 50-40 against or 60-30 against, which doesn't necessarily seem that unlikely on form?
No. Well, one of the things that would happen is that depending who by then is in government, they would say, well, that was the will of the people, and the fact that it was the will of the people 2 years before, that matters nothing. That was the vote and that stands. I'm not quite as absolutely confident as a lot of people that Theresa May is going to get the mandate or the unequivocal mandate that she's looking for as Prime Minister in the British general election, because I think that the balance is much more finely drawn than she would like it to be. And if she's making this, as it appears, into an election on Brexit, and if it turns out that a majority of the population is having second thoughts and they decide to vote on the issue of Brexit, then she might find that instead of having a much bigger majority, even the landslide that apparently she wants, she might find herself with a lot less. Then what happens? Then you've got something which I always find, extremely, I think it's very, very important, actually. You've got a referendum result, and then you'll have the result of a parliamentary election, and you've got two types of democracy if they come up with different results that are actually pitted against each other. And that would be very, very interesting, just in terms of British politics.
Robert, British media is today ablaze with reports leaked to Frankfurter Allgemeine, which I've just woefully mispronounced, the newspaper in question. Everyone knows what I'm talking about. Exactly. Reports of an allegedly disastrous meeting which occurred last Wednesday between Theresa May and Jean-Claude Juncker. The reports have been semi-denied by Downing Street. They do sound somewhat plausible, though, don't they?
I think it's something that Mary alluded to. The trouble is putting me on with Mary. I just about agree with everything she says, only she puts it better than I do. So,
totally.
So bad luck, listeners. But taking on Mary's point, I absolutely agree that this is a game of mirrors. We are in a post-truth world where people have different conceptions of reality. This is, I think, the thing that the EU representatives of this dinner confronted. Really, the task of unbuilding something that took 40 years to build up, just in terms of the law, actually where the European...
I'm tickled by the reports of Juncker producing the hard-bound copies of the Canadian trade deal and Croatia's accession agreement, which are, of course, 10, million pages long and weigh half a ton. I exaggerate slightly for comic effect.
Mary and I will have been to seminars, even assisted, by a man now retired from the LSE called Professor Howard Machin. Howard Machin was the expert on the acquis communautaire. He made a living out of this. It is an enormous document. And how you think you can undo this, I've talked to British government lawyers who say it is very difficult. They're finding it very difficult to get through to their ministers. I would like to pick up a point that Mary made, and I want to emphasise it. In the world of democracy in the UK, which is based on British pragmatism and precedent, is that you can revoke almost anything. Probably, well, certainly it has happened, the sovereign is the head of state by statute. And suddenly we're being told that a very narrow vote, plebiscite, in other words, a referendum by the people, is irrevocable under any terms. This is plainly nonsense. Now, I'm slightly going to break the rules. I had a conversation in a corridor, just quickly and casually, with John Kerr, Lord John Kerr, as he is now, Sir John Kerr, who actually was the architect of Article 50. Mm-hmm. And he emphasised to my friend Bill Keegan and myself, we were just having a quick chat, a serious chat. He said, you boys keep going. You're absolutely right. Everything is revocable and can be amended and can be adjusted. And I agree with Mary, if my inference is correct. I think that the Mayites and people like David Davis and Fox saying, you know, full steam ahead, the steamroller has no reverse gear, is absolute nonsense. We are going to have a very troubled 2 years, and which I think surprisingly little will be resolved.
Mary, if we look ahead to that 2 years, which as Robert suggests is going to be troubled, I would also add just tedious, rancorous and avoidable. What potential tipping points are there in terms of public opinion? If, I mean, noticeably bad economic news, more and more companies, more and more agencies deciding to relocate elsewhere, what are the things that the Brexiteers will not be wanting to see?
I think company relocations, especially banking relocations, probably won't bother people too much. If you start having car plants who've established themselves in the UK, Japanese especially, building cars in the UK, because those cars can then be imported into Europe without additional tariffs, then there are going to be a lot of people, including, ironically, a lot of people who voted for Brexit, who are going to find themselves out of jobs in places where there aren't that many other jobs to do. Then I think things start getting very, very difficult. You could say the same thing possibly about steel. You know, there've been all sorts of promises that there'll be a revival of British manufacturing and heavy British industry, that this will be a sort of byproduct, and the unpopular side of it, like banking and those sort of things, at a sort of people's level, that those sort of things, they might be affected, but they won't necessarily affect public opinion negatively. But I think if it starts really hitting masses of jobs, then, but of course, on the other side, you know, just to argue against that, big question of migration that got mixed up. European yes. migration and non-European migration got totally mixed up with the whole referendum question. And unless Theresa May or whoever becomes Prime Minister can answer that question, which was so much a part of the referendum, then I think the balance is going to remain quite delicate.
Final quick thought from you on this, Robert. We've seen it's 20 years today that Labour won a thumping majority in a general election and brought Tony Blair into office for 10 years. He has reappeared in the last few days, saying he wants to be more involved in the debate. He's very pro-Remain. Given the extraordinary loathing that exists for him, especially among people who purport to support the party that he led to its greatest triumphs, is that a help or a hindrance, do you think?
I think marginally it's a help, because I think that the really interesting part about Tony Blair is more of the good side is being remembered. And there was, you know, you can't just go on Iraq, 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 and it was an awful blunder. As you know, as I never cease to rail on about. But people like Alistair Campbell are writing some very fine journalism about the realities of negotiation and about the EU. I just wanted to give a quick word on what Mary was saying. Taxes. She's got to put up taxes. And if this is hooked on Brexit, then she is in trouble. She is working from the wrong playbook. She's working from the Cameron playbook, which was designed by your fellow countryman, Lyndon Crosby, by chipping away at little constituencies. Whereas if people are saying, particularly in the North, the older people, the people who really went heavily for Brexit, well, it is not a quite so good after all, then I think we're going to be talking about fundamentals and reality like welfare and the health service, which there are all sorts of things that have got to be done. And whatever has to be done, despite the inefficiencies and so on that you can accuse them of at the moment, it's going to cost a lot more money.
Well, let's look now towards the Russian resort of Sochi, which yesterday hosted an exceptionally tedious Grand Prix and tomorrow hosts what promises to be a livelier encounter between Russian President Vladimir Putin and German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Listeners already braced for a Baroque comparison between the two events may stand down. Such a contrivance was briefly attempted. It is a slow afternoon, but abandoned on the grounds that Daniel Kvyat didn't really get close enough to Sebastian Vettel for any parallel of a Russo-German contest to stand up. Mary, first of all, how much will either Merkel or Putin be looking forward to this?
Probably neither of them a great deal. It's probably one of these ordeals that both of them think they have to get through because it would look rather bad if 2 years went by and they hadn't actually met one-on-one. So I think there's a bit of that. I think there's also some interesting business for them to at least discuss because Merkel has been to see Trump in one of the least successful meetings that Trump had with anybody.
And that's saying something at this point.
Exactly. But of course, being so unsuccessful with Trump was also a big feather in Angela Merkel's cap and will serve her very well in the run-up to her elections. But she probably travels to Sochi with sort of information maybe about the sort of state of America and the state of Trumpism that could actually be very useful to Vladimir Putin. And, of course, you'd rather get the impression that Trump is sort of leaving, as indeed Obama tried to do, he's leaving the Europeans to their own business. And so, for instance, Ukraine, which will be very high on the agenda between Merkel and Putin, which we haven't heard of very much, even in recent months, that really that is something for the Europeans to try and sort out. And so I think that is one of the things that will be close to the top of the agenda. And then, of course, there'll probably be a finger-wagging warning from Angela Merkel to say, and don't you even think of interfering in the German elections.
Robert, on that thought of the finger-wagging from Merkel, how seriously would any of that be taken by Russia on any subject, in particular things like Ukraine and Syria, which Merkel's spokesman said will come up? Does Russia take Germany more or less seriously than it might have done a year or two ago? I guess, is Russia obliged to take Germany more seriously now that Britain is leaving the EU, that America is clearly having a funny mood, and that France might?
I think personality really does count here. And I think that Putin does recognize that Merkel is one of the few grown-ups left in the room. And he would be very interested in her assessment. I absolutely agree with Trump. What is Trump really going to do about Syria, first of all, where he's in quite a pickle because they've got a bad egg with Assad, because Assad cannot survive on his own. He really does rely on the Russians, but the Russians don't have the swing vote in Assad's policy. Sorry to repeating yet again. It's Iran, because Iran runs Hezbollah to a degree that I discover more and more shockingly that Iran is funding now 75-80% of the funding of Hezbollah. So there's a whole area there. I think the news will be quite good, by the way, there, that actually Trump, despite launching the Tomahawk missiles, which wasn't particularly rash, it was in the rules of international law, proportionality, appropriateness, and so on. I think that won't worry Putin about the wildness of Trump. The wildness of Trump really comes to the fore a bit on Iran, as I've mentioned, but certainly on North Korea. And that's where he may suddenly jump out of the box. And it looks very, very, very ominous, because that's where a sudden misstep can cause an awful problem and will cause some kind of, albeit I hope it'll be extremely local, but conflagration. Ukraine, I completely agree with Mary. It's looking like the Brer Rabbit tar baby. It's something that nobody really wants to pick up. I think even the Donbass is a bit of a nuisance to Putin now. Mary is much better read in on that. And certainly Ukraine and its corruption of the regime in Kiev is no welcome guest to the EU, nor to NATO, for that matter. And I do think that Brexit will come up, because Vladimir is bound to say, what the hell do you think those Brits are up to?
Well, on that subject, Mary, because it is my suspicion that personal relationships, random though they can be, between leaders do actually make a difference to how business gets done, even at the state level. What do we know of the relationship between Merkel and Putin? Do they basically get on?
I think they get on in a rather basic way. I don't think they particularly like each other. I think that they probably are rather suspicious of each other. But they have one huge advantage over two other leaders, which is each speaks the other's mm-hmm. language. And that's very unusual. And they both speak it well. So they speak it well enough to understand the nuances, even if it doesn't come over particularly successfully. I'd also just add one other point, which I think could be quite interesting, is that Merkel could actually expect some payback from Putin this time around, because Germany has stood up successfully, I think, for the building of the second Nord Stream pipeline. And there's been a lot of hostility to this inside the European Union, especially from Poland and the Baltic states, who've stood up for Ukraine and said this pipeline will bypass Ukraine and therefore remove a lot of revenue from Ukraine and, by the way, a degree of political leverage. But Germany has insisted on this, and it appears that Nord Stream 2 will now go ahead. And Putin has reason to be extremely grateful for that, and she could expect something in return.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox. After the break, France.
Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield, and I want to tell you about an exciting event we've got coming up. On the 11th of May, we'll open the doors of Midori House here in London for a special episode of The Foreign Desk with a live audience. Up for discussion? The French election.
The problem is they've got to have somebody to vote for, and the choice will be between the National Front and a Conservative candidate. But this is where the implosion of the left really is, I think, the tragedy for France at the moment.
With an expert panel of guests, including journalist and author Jonathan Fenby and the AFP's London Bureau Chief Florence Biedermann, we'll ask not only what the election could mean for the future of France, but also for Europe in the age of rising populism.
She presents herself as a kind of Jeanne d'Arc in a way, you know, like a national heroine who defends the country. But in what she doesn't say, she eliminates so many things.
We'll have the results. We've got the panel. All we need now is you. If you'd like to be in the audience, head to monocle.com to get your tickets today. That's The Foreign Desk Live on Thursday, the 11th of May at 1900 with me, Steve Bloomfield.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox. And let's look now at France, which this time next week will have elected president either a centrist insurgent almost nobody had heard of a year ago, or a far-right populist whose problem may be an excess of brand recognition. Polls continue to suggest that Emmanuel Macron has a handy lead over Marine Le Pen, but polls also suggest that bewildering quantities of sanctimonious poseurs are preparing to abstain. In Paris today, three riot police were injured in anti-Le Pen protests, but as this order of mayhem over something or other is more or less traditional on May 1st in Paris, we should probably not overanalyze that. Robert, first of all, is this looking to you like the lock for Macron that everybody assumes that it is?
Well, the polls would have to go dramatically wrong.
I mean, modern standards, they would have to be a million miles out.
And they were pretty good on round one. but you've got two candidates that a hell of a lot of French men and women really don't like. And that is, we've seen it in America, we're seeing it again. And there is a lot of sensible analysis and commentary, which is saying, yeah, but if you get President Macron, he's got no party behind him. He's going to face legislative elections. He is expected to lead in discussions like Brexit, like sorting out Greece, like sorting out Italy, like the increasingly authoritarian posturing of the eastern flank of the EU, not only Poland and Hungary, but now Sweden. And there's just too much. And then you heard his rhetoric just today and over the weekend saying, yes, I'm the man to lead and we will benefit from the removal of the Brits. We will pick up. It looks like a pretty sick old country to me because there are plenty of things that are not good about the French economy and there are plenty of things that are not good about French society. And I agree with Mary. The big question is going to be the stay away.
Mary, how concerning is it that if the polls are right, and even if the polls are right and Le Pen is beaten, how worrying is it that 40% of the electorate of a 21st century Western European country are, you know, willing to vote for a creature such as her?
Well, I suppose that if you were French and not necessarily a Le Pen supporter, you might say, well, there is a sort of 25%, maybe fairly steady support for Marine Le Pen and for the far right. And then there's maybe, if we're going to look at 60-40, then there's maybe an extra 15% who sort of meet around the back, either from the far left, or they are so opposed to Macron and everything he stands for, whether it's banking, whether it's big finance, whether it's pro-Europeanism, that you hitch the sort of anti-European vote to the Le Pen vote and you say, well, it's not really an extreme right vote. It's more generalised than that. It's more anti-European than sort of xenophobic and all that. But obviously, first of all, it is worrying if there's going to be 40% of those who turn out to vote who vote for what Marine Le Pen represents, even though she's trying hard in the current, in the 2 weeks between the first and the second rounds, actually to present herself as not representing that. But I think that the other thing that comes out of it is, even if it's 60-40, what you see in France, as you saw in the first round and you'll probably see in the second round, is what we've seen in practically every election that we've had in a democratic country over the last 2 years, which is a relatively close result with a lot of support for, you know, what in general terms is called populism, though the term is sort of challenged. But that public opinion and the voters are split really quite. You've got countries which are divided absolutely practically down the middle.
Final quick thought from you on this, Robert. If you are a French voter and your preferred candidate didn't get up in the first round, is there a moral argument for abstention rather than turning up and voting against Marine Le Pen? This is an echo, of course, of when her father made the second round against Chirac a decade or so back and the posters went up everywhere saying vote for the crook, not the fascist.
Well, for me personally, it's a bad season because I'm losing so many good journalistic friends. But the best editor I ever worked for died a weekend ago, a man called Piero Ottone, who spoke 10 European languages. But working for a European paper like Le Monde, like Corriere, as I did, you're actually in the world of Descartes. And it is you can have a highly intellectual, abstract discussion. And I think it goes with the lifeblood of French education, of French discourse, and it's why they think they're so superior, as indeed they are, philosophically speaking, in many respects. There are very pure arguments for abstention. So I agree with Mary. I think it's going to be a fascinating result, and do watch out.
Well, finally tonight, the weekend just passed saw this year's iteration of the annual White House Correspondents Association dinner. This is a much beloved Washington tradition in which a room full of journalists smarten themselves up as best they can and congratulate each other on their integrity and sagacity, and the usual highlight of which is a gentle roasting of and self-deprecating monologue by the incumbent president. This year, however, Donald Trump became the first president in 36 years not to show up, and Ronald Reagan had the reasonable plausible excuse of recovering from an assassination attempt. Before we talk about it, some highlights of past and more recent past. We will start with 2011. You may remember this.
Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising since I just assumed he was running as a joke.
No one is happier, no one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter. Like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell? And where are Biggie and Tupac? In an episode of Celebrity Apprentice, you, Mr. Trump, recognized that the real problem was a lack of leadership. You fired Gary Busey. And these are the kind of decisions that would keep me up at night.
One voice there you may have recognized before, that Seth Meyers. That was from 2011. This is Hassan Minhaj from This Weekend.
I love that everybody's drinking, having a good time. This is beautiful. You know Donald Trump doesn't drink, right? Does not touch alcohol, which is oddly respectable. But think about that. That means every statement, every interview, every tweet, completely sober. How is that possible? We've all had that excuse, haven't we? Be like, I said what? No, listen, babe, I swear to you, I was hammered. That's not who I really am. What does Donald Trump tell Melania? Listen, babe, last year on that bus with Billy Bush, that's exactly who I am. Who is tweeting at 3 a.m. sober? Donald Trump, because it's 10 a.m. in Russia. Those are business hours.
The difference between then and now being, of course, that the punchline is now the president. Mary, first of all, should Trump have gone? Should he have just gone along, sucked it up, joined in the laughter, perhaps attempted to charm the press corps?
No, I think it was a completely lost cause, and I think he was absolutely right to stay away. I actually thought that he would simply go away and host somebody down at Mar-a-Lago, instead of which he went to the back end of Pennsylvania to talk to his family. Club.
And slag off the press.
But I actually think it's time, it's beyond time, that the White House Correspondents' Dinner was simply done away with. It's grown exponentially over the years. It was always a slightly embarrassing occasion. And it became more and more populated, not just with the press sort of lauding each other and saying how wonderful they are, as you said in your intro about, you know, the great integrity and all the rest of it. But they then sort of attracted all sorts of Hollywood people to pay for lavish tables, and the whole thing became a sort of mini Oscars. I mean, it was totally ridiculous. So I think, I mean, if Trump's absence signals the end of the foreign correspondence of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, then so much the better.
What do you think, Robert? Are you a fan of the idea or the actuality of the dinner?
The trouble is, when it came to the stand-up, Obama was better than any of them, which is his timing was perfect. I'd like to make a more serious point. I think something my late friend, who I'm still mourning, Rupert Cornwall, thought the mainstream media, this was his last article he wrote for The Independent about 4 weeks ago, was doing absolutely the right job with Trump. From a distance, and I'm a lifelong reader of the New York Times, I think it's doing absolutely the wrong job. I think they're fighting him on his own ground, and it's looking shrill, it's looking hysterical. Look how the Washington Post, which was a dead duck and seemed to be going out of the news business about 3-4 weeks ago, is handling it so much better. They're taking it piece by piece and taking each thing as it comes along, and so they're wonderfully taking it apart piece by piece.
Robert Fox and Mary Dejewski, thank you for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Fiametta Chisana. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. More music next at 1900. It's Culture with Rob Bound. I'll have more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.